Okay. Our program today is Madison UU's and Low Power Radio. And I'm Bob Park, and my wife Barb is familiar with what went on in our garage. We'll get to that a bit later.
So we have no people.
We are it, I think. January of 2007, Prairie had a talk Sunday morning on propaganda corporations and the media by Leah Zeldin, a local radical activist. And that was my introduction to Low Power Radio, because she mentioned that they were working on getting a low power radio station going, and they had a radio council, and I joined that. Later that year, the fall of that year, we had our first test broadcast. But let me back up a bit to talk about the first round of low power radio applications, which happened in 2000-2001. Low power radio was something that developed out of concern for the consolidation of major radio stations, Clear Channel gobbling up stations and getting rid of local news broadcasts and that sort of thing. And also because in the 20th century, in the 1980s, 1990s, pirate radio was something going on in certain places, which the Federal Communications Commission did not approve of. It was illegal, but the things going on were usually too small for them to bother with. I know there was one pirate radio station associated with what's now Badger Radio on campus, ham radio, people who have office on top of the engineering research building. And if you go into their files, you'll see a story about a pirate radio station, how people discovered this unusual station and that sort of thing. It was just an off and on sort of thing. Anyway, low power radio, LPFM for short, is the FCC's response to this, making it legal to have a low power radio station licensed by the FCC. There's no cost for the license, but there are various limitations, such as cannot be more than 100 watts effective radiated power. Has to be owned by an organization, not by an individual. And in the case of Madison, during that first round, there were six applicants for what the FCC said was the only available license in Madison, after they had licensed a religious station on the eastern edge of Madison. So what happened was that these six applicants it was proposed that they each have the license temporarily, and they didn't think that was a very good idea. And they got together and organized two coalitions. The two secular organizations formed the Madison Nonprofit Low Power Radio Group, and the four Christian organizations formed the Madison Christian Low Power Radio Group, and operating under the names Citywide and Soulwide, they shared the airtime 50-50. Citywide and Soulwide were the names they chose because the call letters for the station are WIDE. Like all low power stations, we're supposed to say LP at the end of that to indicate we're low power. So those two groups formed an umbrella group, Madison Mainstream Radio. This was before I got involved, which got federal government 501c3 status, and that group was responsible for the two partners running the one station. So they each were represented on the MMR board, and that's how we ran the station for several years. And the first test broadcast occurred from our technical director's house in the fall of 2007, and we were then aiming to get on the air in spring of 2008, and we even had a kickoff event scheduled at Prairie Unitarian University Society, and oops, there are technical problems, let us work on these. And it was actually September of 2008 that we finally got on the air, and the location was our garage, because it was available, and it if we hadn't gotten on the air then, we would have had to go back and start all over again. We got extensions and extensions and from the FCC and that sort of thing. So Barbara remembers when I told her about...
Came home and said, what have you heard? There was a radio station in our garage. Sure.
So
just for a little while.
A few minutes.
That's what it turned out. Right. So I put together a tower that I stuck to a ventilator in the garage roof, and with some pipes that we had on hand, and tried that out briefly, and then I got some more pipes from the test location where our technical director's house had, he'd stuck it on up on his roof attached to a chimney. Added those on and got another 8.5 feet for our antenna, but it was still only 35 feet above the garage floor, so it wasn't really high enough to clear the treetops. But we went on the air, and I got lots of practice running the station, and eventually the second round of radio applications came around in 2013, and we persuaded our Christian partner to apply for their own license. They said they had been interested in that, and we had always from the outset said we'll do this partnership until there's more opportunity for more stations. And the low power radio, the Community Radio Act had been passed in Congress and signed by President Obama, and that greatly expanded the number of available licenses, because prior to that, the full power stations were saying, oh, you're going to interfere with us, even in the National Association of Broadcasters, and even public radio were opposing the low power radio station licenses. But after it was studied, it was found that all this concern was, there wasn't much reason for all that concern, and it really was possible to have a lot more of these low-power stations without causing problems for the full-power stations. So, 5 new applications went in from the Madison area, including all the way to Sun Prairie, 4 community radio applications, and 1 Christian, that Christian one being our former partner, and they went on the air in 2015, and we also went off the air in 2015 because it turned out that the coordinates that our technical director had submitted when we got approval to broadcast initially were a little off, and that according to those coordinates, we would have been broadcasting from a sidewalk north of the just of the Beltline Highway, and that would have been legal, but the actual coordinates of our house were a little bit too close to a station in Dodgeville. There were certain limits set up in the federal requirements, and so we were advised it'd be a good idea to shut down and get a better location, and we wanted a better location anyway, and the other station was our former partner was about to get on the air, so... we shut down at the end of July in 2015. They got on the air in August, I think it was, and then we got a new location and a better location, a place to put a higher antenna up, and got on the air again in October of 2015. So that's what we've been doing since then.
Pine tree.
And it happened that the only practical place to put our antenna was at the top of this 70-foot pine tree in the back of the Skogs' backyard. It happened to be virtually ideal as a tree to climb and install something in, except for the pine pitch, which I got on my clothing when I climbed the tree. But it had a Y at the top where I could install a support system for the lightweight antenna, and I needed a lightweight antenna, but our antenna was only a 2.2-pound antenna. Since then, I've taken pictures during stormy, gusty weather, and the tree It's a pretty sturdy tree, but it still sways back and forth, and you can see the antenna flipping back and forth. But it's lightweight enough that it survived all those storms and has done fine. So we are relocated. We did have to reduce our power because the location of that yard is on higher ground, and the federal requirement is that you can only be 98 feet above average terrain, and we are already starting above average terrain, so antenna at 73 feet was above where we could broadcast at 100 watts. The FCC only allows you to cover a theoretical area of about 3.5 miles radius from your antenna. And we had to cut back to 40 watts at the top of that tree, but it's still giving us a better range than we had before from a shorter antenna in a poorer location. So we've been broadcasting from there, and we've also formed an association of community low-power radio stations, including Elizabeth. And why don't you tell us about your station?
Okay.
How it got started.
So WMUU was part of the most recent round of applications for the FCC. The FCC seems to have a window maybe once every 10 years. It seems to be their average. So the process started in October, I want to say, late 2013. And it was originally going to be, the woman who sort of got it started initially, Kelly Warren, is involved with the Madison Institute. And the idea had originally been that it would be a project of the Madison Institute, but they decided that they were not interested in being responsible for the license. And legally, if you're going to, as Bob said earlier, you have to, not only can a nonprofit, you'll edit all of this stuff out. Not only can a low power radio station not be owned by an individual, it has to be owned by an organization, and it has to be a nonprofit organization. So Kelly got in touch with Norm Stockwell from WORT, who put her in contact with Andy Gussert, who at the time was the chief operations officer at First Unitarian Society, which is where I currently work. And First Unitarian Society decided that they would be the owners of this license. So at that point, that would have probably been decided late 2013, early 2014. I was hired in the fall of 2014 in October as the podcast specialist. So I was put in charge of, as well as podcasting, all of the sermons that we do at First Unitarian every Sunday, also recording special events, talks, panels that we periodically have at First Unitarian, and putting together a online podcast library, which we now have on SoundCloud. And we secured space at Central Properties downtown on State Street, and that's where our tower and our antenna and our transmitter, emergency alert system, all of our equipment is there. But the day-to-day operations, at least from FUS, are run at First Unitarian Society in my office. And what we have right now is we're on the air 24/7, and it's not a formal like two organizations provide. Well, actually, I guess it is. So there are some radio stations called MX groups where you'll have, like what Bob said, you'll have two organizations sharing the license, sharing the programming. And here, FUS is the sole owner of WMUU, but we get about 12 hours of programming a day from Kelly Warren. And then I provide the other 12 hours of, the Madison Institute. And then I provide the other 12 hours of programming. And we are mostly automated. We have a few live shows. We do a live stream of our Sunday services at 9 and 11. We also do a broadcast of recordings from the new musicales, which are classical, mostly classical music events that we have at First Unitarian every Friday. We also broadcast recordings of past sermons. And then we also have a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night show called Live from the Fountain, which is currently hosted by a Madison musician named Durango McMurphy, and that takes place from 8 to 10, three nights a week. And then the rest of
that's
live. That's live. Yep, that's our live content. And the rest of it is just put into an automation system and sent to the transmitter, and the transmitter sends it out.
Now, I have a question about the live music broadcast. Do you have to get a license of any sort?
So if you want to, the current situation is that if you're a radio station of any kind and you want to broadcast music, you need to have 7 licenses. You need to have 2 each from ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC, which are called PROs, or performance rights organizations. So you need to have a web license for your web stream, which not all radio stations have. If you are not doing a web stream, you would only need 4 licenses, but most, I think, probably 99.9% of radio stations now have a web stream. So you need 2 licenses from CSAC, BMI, and ASCAP, and then you also need a separate license from an organization called Sound Exchange. And Sound Exchange is the licensor that makes sure, or the organization rather, that makes sure that people who produce the music and perform the music are getting paid, as well as the composers.
And they're the ones that deal with the web streaming.
Yeah.
And do you have to pay per hit on your...
You have to pay, sort of. So all of these licensing organizations, they have special rates for low-powered stations because they know that because you're so much smaller than, say, Z104 or National Public Radio, that you're not going to have as many listeners as those larger organizations or those larger radio stations. So they're pretty affordable. Sound Exchange has a flat rate of $500 for LPFMs. I think we pay about $1,500 a year for our licenses.
For all of them.
For all of them. And then as far as reporting, for low-powered radio stations, there are no reporting requirements for ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC. You have to make those, you have to provide stats on request. You have to give them 2 weeks' worth of streaming and listener statistics if they ask. But I think it's pretty rare that they would ask you for that.
So while you've been at WMUU, have you had any requests?
I have not.
Okay.
Sound Exchange is a little more elaborate. They do require that I send them quarterly reports of all the music that I've played, but because we only have 1 2-hour music show where I am required to give music to Sound Exchange due to the fact that it's music from MP3, CD, as opposed to just a recording of a live performance. That's the only music show that we have where I'm required to submit stuff to Sound Exchange. And because it's just one show, all I have to do is put in a playlist and then the information that they ask me for, which I usually just approximate, and then I submit it. And because it's far below a certain threshold where I would have to pay actual royalties, I don't have to pay anything beyond the $500 a year.
Okay, so most of your time then is talk shows?
Yes, the majority of our content is talk programming. We rebroadcast a public affair from WORT, which is great. It's probably one of our more popular shows. And we also get 3 shows from Pacifica Radio. We are a Pacifica Radio affiliate station. And the rest of the programming is either stuff that I have recorded at First Unitarian or Kelly has recorded with the Madison Institute, or it's content from Public Radio Exchange, which is a radio content distribution website. It's very popular. A lot of people, pretty much everybody I've worked with at National Public Radio or a public radio affiliate station has used it.
I contacted them once and found out they had a special rate for low-power stations of $100
a year. $100 a year. It's a really good deal. We probably get about 2/3 of our content from PRX.
And what is the attitude of First Unitarian Society been? I know Andy had pretty ambitious-sounding ideas for the low-power station when he first pitched it to them. And that first year, he told me he spent 20 minutes convincing the board to come up with $5,000 to support the first year of operation.
Yeah.
What's happened since then?
Since then, we did a survey, actually, of the station a couple of months ago. We had, we just asked people in the congregation what they thought about well, first of all, had they heard of the station? What did they think about it? Had they listened? How many times had they listened? I got back about 180 responses, and people were generally positive. There were a few folks who were sort of like, you know, why do we have this? Could we be spending our money on other things? But the people who had listened and liked it were really positive. One person told me that WMUU, WORT, and Wisconsin Public Radio are the three stations they listen to the most, which was nice to hear. So in general, people have either been neutral or positive.
So have there been annual grants for the station?
There have not. So our first 2 years of funding have been provided from a donor from the Madison Institute. He gave us 2 years worth of funding, so that's about $10,000. $10,000, and that money will be running out after this fiscal year. So beginning next year, we'll have to come up with a new source of funding, and we haven't determined that yet.
But you're not expecting it to come from First Society?
Probably not from First Unitarian Society. We certainly don't have any money earmarked or in a reserve fund specifically to fund WMUU. If we did fund it in any way, it would just come from our general operating account.
So has this been discussed at their annual budget talks about whether to have a budget item for the station?
Not really. And there's, because I'm going to be actually leaving in 5 months to take a new position, we haven't made any decisions yet, but we're probably going to start the process of transferring the license to another nonprofit.
Uh-huh. But that has to have a 3-year time period, right?
Yes. So legally, we have to hold the license until August of 2018. So there's going to be at least a year where the operations and ownership is kind of in limbo. But I think they'll figure something out. I'll be here at least for another 5 months, and I can, you know, I'll be around to advise a bit on that. But because I'm not the current executive director of First Unitarian Society, I'm like legally, there's not a whole lot I can say about it, because she's the only one who's legally in that position to do so.
And another problem you've got to deal with is the demolition of the building where your transmitter is.
Yeah, so yeah, the demolition of the building, which nobody has... So I haven't heard officially when that's going to happen. I don't even know for sure if it's going to happen. We have scouted a few possible locations. One of them would be the Madison Senior Center. And because the Madison Senior Center is less than a mile from our current location, filing relocation paperwork with the FCC would be fairly easy.
It's a minor modification.
Exactly. It's a minor modification. We would still have to probably submit a location study to the FCC, just because we did that before. And due to our location, there's a couple of other radio stations, small and large, that we could potentially encroach on. So we would definitely have to submit another study. But other than that, the paperwork itself would be easy because, like you said, it's a minor modification.
So you've talked already with the senior center?
We've talked with, there's an employee at First Unitarian, or no, there's an employee at the senior center who's also a member of First Unitarian Society. So we have broached the subject with him, and I think he's been in talks with them, but we haven't made any official decisions.
So you don't know yet when you're going to have to move?
We don't know yet when we're going to have to move. We don't know when that building's being demolished. We don't know if it's going to be demolished. The person who owns it hasn't contacted me in 6 months. So, yeah.
Now, your setup is different than ours because our transmitter is located in a garage, wired directly to the antenna.
Mm-hmm.
How do you connect from your office to the...
Transmitter.
Mm-hmm. Do you deal with the? How do you make changes in your programming?
Yeah. So we use a automation system called Airtime Pro, which is all run online. It's actually owned by a company in the Czech Republic. And how it works is that Kelly and I both have logins, and we'll just log in and upload content, and then we have a computer at the transmitter site, which is connected to the transmitter, and that computer is set up to listen, I'm in air quotes here, listen to the stream that's coming out of Airtime, and then that gets sent to the transmitter. So it's all being run off of a computer.
So Airtime is on the broadcast computer at the transmitter
yep.
site?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have you had any problems with this connection?
We haven't had any problems with airtime itself. As long as there's content scheduled, you'll have something on the air. Mm-hmm. Typically, what we're more likely to encounter, and probably the number one troubleshooting activity that I have to do there, is just restarting the computer, because for reasons that we're not entirely sure of, the computer will just stop running. So we have to go over there and restart it and then wait a minute and then it'll come back. You'll actually hear that ba-bum, ba-bum, like that, the sound that Windows computers make when they're turning back on. You'll actually hear that on the air, and then you'll wait about 10 seconds and then the programming will come back. That happens periodically. And then the internet that we have set up is through a local 4G Wi-Fi provider, and generally it works fine, and it's nice because it's really affordable and it's a local company. But in October and November of last year, we had a lot of internet outages, so we had to go back and restart the computer and get us back on the air constantly, because our internet connection would constantly drop, and therefore our computer couldn't connect to airtime, and we had no programming on the air. And I never figured out exactly what it was, but my theory was because it was during midterms and our transmitter is on State Street. But my theory was is that other people were connecting to that internet and the bandwidth was being exceeded and we kept losing our connection. So I haven't confirmed that, but that's my theory. And I ran it by an engineering friend who said, yeah, that's probably what happened.
The downside of being by the university.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. And of not having a more secure internet service provider.
Now, do you have access to the transmitter any time of day or night, or does it have to be?
You can connect to the transmitter remotely online.
Can you restart the computer remotely?
Mm-mm, mm-mm.
So if you had to actually go in and restart the computer, would you be locked out in the middle of the night?
No. I mean, I actually live about 2 blocks away from our transmitter site, which is quite useful for me.
You have a key.
And I have a key. Yep. Oh, so okay. I can get into the building, into that office anytime I need.
Oh, great.
And there are, there are ways that you can connect to that computer remotely. This is the way we have it set up now. I cannot. But if we had a more, I don't know, sophisticated technology setup, then it would be really easy to just log into that computer itself remotely, and then I could restart the computer from my home. But as it is, it's a 5-minute walk. It's fine.
Maybe you'd like to tell us where you're going after you quit your job at
the UFS First Unitarian. I'm leaving First Unitarian at the end of September, and I will be working as a communications operator at McMurdo Research Station in Antarctica.
That's the right time to be going.
Yes. So it'll be our winter, their summer. I'm going to be working for a contracting company called PAE, which stands for Pacific Architects and Engineers. It's going to be about 50 to 60 hours a week of work. And what I've been telling people, to keep it really simple, is I'm going to be babysitting scientists with two-way radios, because the rule is anytime you leave the base, you have to take a two-way radio with you and you have to check in every 24 hours. So basically we're using VHF radio to keep track of everybody moving outside of the base, and people are checking in with you constantly. And it sounds like it can be pretty fast-paced and pretty intense. And but it also sounds like a lot of fun. And I think when I read the job description, I thought, oh, that looks similar enough to the radio operations I did at Wisconsin Public Radio for 5 years, that, yeah, I can probably do this. So, yeah, I'm pretty excited. And McMurdo actually has a low-powered radio station.
Oh, it does.
It's called ICE 104.5. I think it broadcasts at about 50 watts. I don't know if it's under the jurisdiction of the FCC. That's something I'd have to find out. Because McMurdo is a U.S. station, but it's not...
U.S. property, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's something I'm going to have to look into. And ICE 104.5 does not have a website. And one thing that I want to try to figure out before I go is if I could... either build a website myself or have the National Science Foundation like help me build a website or build it myself, and then I do work. I have no idea how I would pull that off, but I would really love to get a website for ICE 104 and also put together a web stream. And even though the internet at McMurdo is really, really limited and people at McMurdo may not be able to stream the station, if people in all other parts of the world could stream the radio station. I think that would be really, really fun.
Cool.
And I'm going to carry a recorder with me at all times. I'm going to interview as many people as I can. They also have a newspaper that you can write for, and they have a ham radio station. And I have a technician license, and I'm hoping to get my general sometime this summer so that I can also DX with people. So,
have you had a chance to talk to people down there?
I have not. I do not own ham equipment. I've never actually operated. I just have the license.
One of our members has been down there twice, but unfortunately he's not here today.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be nice to meet him.
Yeah.
So that's my big plan, and after that I'm hoping to do, there's a community radio station in Buenos Aires, Argentina that I'm hoping to get involved with. I also have a lead on doing volunteer journalism in Bulgaria, so I may pursue that next summer.
You're getting very adventurous then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and I lived in Europe for 8 months, 3 years ago, so I've done stuff like this before.
How many languages do you speak?
I can speak some Spanish. It was better when I was traveling around in Spain and Morocco.
But no Bulgarian.
No Bulgarian.
That's a tough language, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you're in Antarctica, is it going to be for a full year? Or
just for 5 months.
Just
actually,
for the summer months,
less,
right?
Yeah, less than that. It starts, I don't have a firm date yet. It's either going to be late September, early October, and then I would come back at the end of February.
Okay.
I've heard people say that that was one of the smoothest landings they ever had.
Mm-hmm, I bet.
Really?
Onto the ice, yeah.
Yeah.
No wind?
There's nothing to hit. Well, I've heard it's really windy over there.
Right.
But... yeah, smooth.
Well, as far as WMUU, does FUS have plans to hire a replacement for you for the fall? Or
they don't. I'm literally irreplaceable.
So who's going to be running the radio station?
It'll probably go to Kelly Warren, just because she kind of got it started. She got the ball rolling.
She's doing half the program.
And she's doing half the programming. She knows how it all works, so...
Well, how sustainable is this? It sounds like it requires a certain amount of money to keep it going, right?
Yeah. WIDE is an example of the bare minimum to keep a station going.
And I figure it takes us about $1,000, slightly more.
About $100 a month.
Yeah.
So maybe $1,200 a year.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's right. With all volunteer,
right?
Everything.
And with no streaming, because that's another $500 a year we can't afford.
Mm-hmm.
We pay the royalty fees and the electricity, and Ken Skog said okay to pay 1/3 of his cost for the internet connection. That satisfies him. So we've got those bills to pay and domain names and that sort of thing.
Okay, so it sounds a lot cheaper than the licensing I was hearing from Elizabeth.
Right.
Yeah.
No, they're
if you're not doing
higher end.
Yeah. If you're not doing an internet stream, then it costs about half, like literally half of what it would cost us.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So just even among low power stations, which are all really low tech and low expense compared to full power stations, there's quite a range from WIDE to another station you'll see there is the one that is owned by the city of Monona.
Okay.
They had $100,000 to get their station going, which they had collected from cable TV franchise fees over the years.
Wow.
They've been talking about doing this for several years.
Yeah.
And they finally, the second round of applications came around, they put it in. We all got our construction permits because we were all asking for different frequencies that were all permissible. So.
Okay. So who owns WIDE? If WMUU.
Well, I mentioned earlier that this Madison Mainstream Radio was an umbrella group. Well, after our former Christian partner got their own station going, they agreed to turn that organization over to us. So now, just this year, the FCC approved the transfer of the ownership to that organization, because it's a 501c3 organization, from Health Writers Incorporated. Now, Health Writers was what Leah Zeldin was involved in, and for many years they put on a program every other week on WORT, and she also had a food program on that station. But that organization, former Prairie member Steve Blank was president of that. Another Prairie member who was involved with the station was Mary Summers. Anyway, when Steve decided to go on to something else and not be president of Health Riders, he turned it over to some other people who said, well, we'll keep it going. And a couple of weeks later, they said, well, we can't do it. So they dropped the program, and it was no longer available on WORT. And the only thing that Health Riders had then was the FCC-approved ownership of a low-power radio station, and these people had never really been involved with it after Steve left. So we elected a new board of people who did support the station, including Barb and me and the two people who have been involved since the beginning, Eric and Tom, and Susan Hagstrom, another member of Prairie. Mm-hmm. And then... that was the board that was responsible for the station for a while. And then the FCC approved, but they didn't have 501c3 status. So the FCC granted our application to transfer the ownership to MMR, which is another organization that had been around for years because it had this previous role for the two partner stations. So we're owned by an organization with a four-member board. Barb and I are half of the board, and we have a few hundred dollars left. So okay. we're starting the fund drive that started on May 1st to try and find enough progressives to keep the station on the air. And we've adopted the motto, Progressive Voices on the Air, which seemed appropriate because of the mic dropping its progressive talk programming right after the election last November. So there's a dearth of that kind of thing. Of course, WORT has always had progressive programming on it, but it hasn't characterized it that way. So,
do you have some ideas of how much listenership you each have? I mean, and how do you determine?
We've never had a survey like they've had, so we've only got occasional feedback from people by email. If you read the article about WIDE, there's an example there of somebody who liked our music.
Oh, yeah. But what does a survey mean? You go around and actually go to house and ask people?
You use email addresses from FUS members, right?
Are you thinking of keeping track of listeners or for the survey? Oh, the survey. So the survey to figure out like what people's opinion was, that was actually just a paper survey that we handed out for two church services.
Okay.
The best way that I've been able to tell how many people are listening is using Airtime. They have an analytics feature where you can see how many people are listening. And it's not...
I said no, though.
But that's just for web or what?
That's just for web.
Okay.
And our web listening or listenership has actually gone up steadily in the almost 2 years that we've been on the air, but it's not super accurate because it just shows you how many times someone has logged in and actually listened. And so that could be one person. Exactly. So that could be one person checking in 10 times over the span of half an hour. So it's not super accurate. As far as people listening on the radio, couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I'm just
curious.
Yeah. Nielsen, which is the... formerly they were Arbitron, now they're Nielsen, they're separate companies, but Nielsen's now the one that does the ratings, and I'll get an email from Nielsen every now and then saying, hey, do you want to, like, give us a bunch of money so that we'll do a survey? And I go, no.
Because we have no money.
Yeah. I don't know how many people we have listening on the radio.
Okay. So it sounds like there's some... possibility. I mean, is there any possibility that WMUU would drop off the air because no one seems to want to fund it? I mean, is that a real possibility?
It could happen. Legally, you can, if you have to go off the air for more than 30 days, you can apply for a special temporary authority from the FCC. And those can be granted for up to 6 months. So if we could show to the FCC that, like, we can't be on the air right now because we're going through a license transfer or because the building where we keep our equipment is being torn down, they can grant us they can give us a leniency and we could be silent for 6 months. If you do not broadcast at all for a year, then your license automatically lapses. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, our station had to do that, get a STA, as they call them, when we went off the air.
Yeah.
And no problem in granting it, and we were able to get back on the air.
Yeah.
Plenty of time.
Yeah. The other part is that LPFMs only have to transmit for 36 hours a week. So theoretically, if it went over to a different nonprofit and they only had the resources or the time to do 36 hours a week, they could do that. The only caveat then would be that you cannot broadcast dead air. If you're going to be off the air, you have to turn the transmitter off.
Right. So otherwise, you get a carrier, which you just shows up on your dial as silence instead of static.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that would be...
You still need the same... license, you still need to pay those ASCAP.
Mm-hmm. You still have to pay those fees.
It doesn't cost you any less, really.
No.
Right. Except for electricity. Maybe,
yeah, that's pretty minor.
But that's such a minor cost.
Yeah.
Right.
So being off the air just on the air part of the time doesn't, unless you're paying somebody to keep you on the air, it doesn't.
Doesn't cost you anything.
Doesn't save
you
money.
No.
If it's all volunteer and the computer's running everything, you just let the
car run. Exactly. Yeah.
How much equipment is involved in a low power radio station, and where the heck do you get it?
You buy it new or used, or you borrow it.
Okay. Is there a transmitter?
Yeah, transmitter, the radio. You're required to have emergency broadcast system equipment. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be hooked up to two different radios to feed into that.
Mm-hmm.
We have something called an OptiMod, which is actually a semi-permanent loan from WSUM, which you used to work for, a student station on campus, because they upgraded their equipment and this was sitting unused. And we went to an open house ahead and say, hey, we could use that. Oh, go ahead.
Is that an audio processor?
You'd have to ask Eric exactly what it does, but it's part of, it goes with the transmitter.
Okay. It's probably an audio processor.
Okay.
In our case, we have a rent-free location for our equipment because we have the garage, which is provided on the condition that we don't use any floor space. So what I did was built... we have an equipment rack that's about this high and this big and that holds everything. I just suspended it from the rafters so they can park their snowblower underneath it. No problem.
Okay.
Yep. Pretty much the same situation with us. We have pretty inexpensive rent with Central Properties. Part of the deal was that in exchange for low rent, we would do this live from the Fountain Show. So we have that, and then we have an old equipment rack from WORT. It's larger than WIDE's. I think it's more like 10 by 4 by 6 feet. And then we have a computer that's a spare from FUS. All of the equipment in my office is stuff that FUS had on hand. So, and then the transmitter, the emergency alert system, the antenna, the tower, those were all purchased with the funds that we were given, the startup money that we got from the Madison Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, I mean, transmitters, if they're used by a full power station, they'll have to get replaced once every 15, 20 years, I think.
Although our partner station, the religious station, bought a transmitter and it only lasted a couple of years. They had to buy another one.
Oh, no.
And then recently they had to go off the air because the city of Monona was developing the parking lot that they were adjacent to, and the tower I helped them put up was attached to a light pole, which was being torn down. So they're looking for a new location.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're off the air.
Off the air, yeah.
Yeah.
And we're waiting to see whether the FCC has approved their temporary authority to go silent.
Yeah. And the equipment cost for running a low power radio station, WIDE, I think, is an example of definitely the most bare bones that you can possibly be to be on the air. And then if you look at a station like the one in Monona, the one in Sun Prairie, the one in on the far west side of Madison, WWMV, the Lucier Center, the Lucier Community Education Center. Their stations are significantly more expensive, in part because they are live, and we have like the two automated stations, and then Monona's is, I think, maybe 50-50
I think it's less than that.
Less than that? Okay. Yeah. But WWMV and WLSP have a lot more live content. And when you have live shows, you have to have a radio board, you have to have microphones, you have to have some basic audio processor. And then because you have volunteers using that equipment constantly, it wears out. You have to repair it or you have to replace it. So stations that are live for at least 50% of the time, they have significantly higher equipment costs because of that.
Well, I mean, it sounds like even if you're an automated system, you have to have a way to take interviews or recordings and edit them down.
Yeah, that's right. True. I have audio editing software on my computer.
Me too.
One of them is a free program called Audacity. And
that's what I use.
Yeah, Audacity's nice because it's free. And then I also have SoundForge and Adobe Audition.
Okay.
Radio stations with much higher budgets will often have something like Pro Tools or Cool Edit. But
okay,
SoundForge,
so that's kind of what you use then, is that sort of general recording software.
Yeah, Audacity is probably the most famous amongst low power FMs again because it's free and it's pretty easy to use.
Okay.
Can't do anything fancy with it, but yeah, if you're just editing a panel or a 2-person interview, which is mostly what our stations do anyway, then it's perfectly fine.
Now, you do a lot of music broadcasting, don't you?
Right. It's mostly music, but there's a lot of talk shows, too. In fact, I was going to show you the weekly schedule. That's the week at a glance at it on the back. And if you were looking at it online, you'd see the color coding that the music is color coded and the talk shows are white.
And so you must have to edit all those songs together to have an automated system.
No, I've got the software running, randomly selecting music from different folders. So at nighttime, I have softer sounds, and the program's called Soft Comes the Night, and it just randomly selects. But what it does is keep track of what it selected last so that it doesn't repeat the same song over and over unless I accidentally left two different versions in the same folder. Sometimes like a best of will have the same song and I didn't. But most of, I have to do a lot of editing for the talk shows, so that's what takes most of my work.
Why'd you edit out the promos or ask?
We're not allowed to have any advertisements, and sometimes podcasts that I have permission to broadcast will start including ads, like Skeptoid is a good program that used to be great without ads, and now it's got an ad at the beginning, an ad at the end, and an ad in the middle. I've got to edit it out, unless I pay them $5 a month to get an ad-free version, and we don't have that money.
So what takes up most of your time, and what takes up most of your time, Elizabeth?
I would say recording and editing interviews is a pretty good chunk of my job. I do some recordings of events that happen at FUS, and all I have to do is show up and set up sound, or sometimes not even set up sound. I just have to put my recorder on the podium and hit start and then edit it later. And then I also go out and do some interviews on my own, like as part of my job, but not necessarily in conjunction with anything FUS is doing. And then I've had a few interviews with people who've contacted the station and said, hey, we have this event coming up and we're hoping we could do an interview with you. And I'll go, sure. So then I'll do like a 10-minute interview with them. And it all goes on our audio archive, which is on SoundCloud.
Then you have to schedule that for broadcast.
And then I load all of that into airtime and have that play as part of the I program everything from 1 a.m. until 1 p.m. and from 1 to 3 and then from 7 to 9 in the morning I have a show called The Local Muse, like M-U-U.
Okay.
And that's all of the content that either I have recorded at FUS or I have recorded as part of my job or that my volunteers have done. So that's kind of like what I like to think of as the flagship of WMUU's locally produced content.
That's a daily program?
Yep. Monday through Friday. And then every other Friday, I have a volunteer who does a poetry show that he records it, I edit it. So every other Friday we'll have a space for poetry. And then once a month I have another volunteer who does an arts show. So Fridays,
I do that on the radio.
Yeah. So he'll interview artists who are doing shows at the Arts and Literature Lab. on the east side, and mostly they just talk about their work and things like that. So Friday is a little more varied. Fridays, I sometimes have a show called The Fountain Appetizers, which is recordings of songs that have been performed on Live from the Fountain.
Okay.
But, yeah, that's the local moves.
Mm-hmm. And I do interviews occasionally at home with this, my recording studio, you see right here. Like, I've got an interview coming up a week from Monday with someone who's starting a new comic book group in Madison called Gemini Comics. And he wants to take stories that have a progressive atmosphere or theme to it.
Right.
So he thought maybe the Beyond a Radio Station would help. I go to rallies sometimes and record the speakers there. I've always gotten the recordings of the Fighting Bob Fest speakers, usually from Norm Stockwell, who did that for WORT, and after he left WORT to become the publisher of The Progressive, he continued to record these programs and provide the copies to me for broadcast, and other events.
Local forums, politicians, talks, the police...
police chief forums and people, candidates for office, debates. I've recorded a number of those, and sometimes I get the interviews done on WORT. We have a local programming sharing agreement with them that allows us to use any of their locally produced programs.
Okay.
So I often take a public affair program that has candidates for office. Carousel Baird does this on Tuesdays sometimes. And I have a books and writers hour each week, and some of the sometimes they interview authors on a public affair or on 8 o'clock buzz. Or on I've gotten permission to broadcast podcasts from a number of places.
Okay.
There's a Lannan Foundation in New Mexico that often has authors on, and really radicals and activists and interesting people. And I edit those into two parts because they're too long to fit an hour. But they always have a reading. They call it a reading that the author talks about what he's written, and then they have a conversation where the question and answer period.
Right.
So I break it up into those two parts for broadcasts on succeeding weeks. Some of the regular programs that come in, like Counterspin, are a bit on the weak side in terms of the audio amplitude, and we don't have hardware or software that really corrects for that, like a better funded station might have. So I edit the file to boost the audio so it doesn't sound quieter when it comes on the air.
And it seems like it would be a challenge to come up with programming for 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
It helps to have music to fill in every time.
I was going to say the automated random music sounds like
right.
that would be a way to do it.
Right. Most of our programming is music, but we have regular talk shows. When we started out the station as a partnership with the Christian group, our time was divided from 10 p.m. to 10 a.m. They had Sundays and we had Friday nights, but each of us had half the time. But I figured that after 12 hours of Christian broadcasting, there should be something giving a broader perspective. So I started this series of programs called Wider Horizons, using WIDE as a reason for the name.
Mm-hmm.
And the Wider Horizons series occurs 5 days a week originally it was at 10 o'clock as soon as the Christian broadcasting ended. Now we have Democracy Now at 9, and that program is back at 10 again. And there's a series of programs, Humanism Today and Voices for Religious Pluralism. That's where we put the talks given at Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, along with talks given at the Ethical Society of St. Louis, where I have permission to broadcast the leaders' talks. Free Thought Radio from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which
we also carry that.
Okay.
and a program from Eau Claire, put out by Mark Helpsmeet.
Spirit in Action.
Spirit in Action.
Yep, we carry that too.
Or Song of the Soul. If he's repeating something I've already broadcast, I'll look for something in his Song of the Soul series and do that instead on the same time slot.
Okay.
He's a Quaker who has been doing this for a number of years. He's based at a low power station in Eau Claire, WHYS, but he also has this program now on some full power stations. So, what else do I do? Science for the People from Edmonton, Alberta on Wednesdays.
That sounds very interesting.
Yeah, the Science for the People is a great show.
Yeah, we've met the woman who started that, although I'm not sure she's still there. Others have taken over more of what she's doing.
What's one program, what's one of the programs that you're most proud of, Bob?
Well, proud of in terms of producing, because I don't produce that many myself.
The ones that you're proudest of sharing with them.
Well, I think... Counterspin and Democracy Now! are very good for giving political input to people who aren't familiar. I mean, it goes well beyond the mainstream media and TV news. Science for the People is good for science. Humanism Today includes content from the American Humanist Association and from the Humanist Union. So whenever I have a Humanist Union meeting, I record that for broadcast.
Okay. Well, what about you, Elizabeth? Which ones are you most proud of?
I'm proud of Exile's Return, which is the 2-hour music show that I produce. I'm airing reruns right now, but I was producing new episodes for about 6 months, and now I'm repeating those. But I'm proud of it partly because I've been a substitute music host on Wart for about 7 years. So I'm glad to finally be like, oh, I have my own music show now. This is fun. And, other reason I'm proud of it is, I put all of the episodes on Public Radio Exchange, and one of the episodes was actually picked up by an NPR affiliate station in California, earlier this year, their producer emailed me, and he's like, yeah, we've got really bad flooding at the station right now, and our regular DJs can't get in, so we're going to air one of your shows. And I went, yay, nationally syndicated, yes. So I'm really happy that I got aired in California. I'm also proud of, there's a show we do, we don't do it, but it's called Alternative Radio with David Barsamian. He does a lot of like lefty public affairs, and his show used to be on Wart, and then Wart switched to, I don't know if it was Democracy Now! Or something else, but nice to bring that back, and from what I can tell, at least online, that's one of our more popular morning shows.
Okay.
We started broadcasting Travel with Rick Steves 6 months before Wisconsin Public Radio did. So there was a period where you'd go to the Travel with Rick Steves radio website and you could see all the radio stations throughout the country that were carrying it. And we were the only station in Wisconsin that had Travel with Rick Steves.
Wow. Okay.
And then Wisconsin Public Radio stole my thunder, but I love them anyway.
Okay.
But I was pretty proud of that for a while.
Now, do you have a frenemy relationship with some of the larger radio stations?
No, not at all. Okay. I still volunteer with Wart. I've been with them for over 8 years. They are wonderful.
Wart.
Sorry.
Yeah,
I mumbled that. WORT. Okay. Been with them for a long time. I also worked at Wisconsin Public Radio for 5 years, mostly doing radio operations, but I was also a board operator on the weekends for about a year and a half, and then I was also an assistant producer with the Joy Cardine show for a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So I've worn a lot of hats there, and there's really, really great people there. I think generally, if there's any animosity, I've never experienced it. I think at best people are pretty neutral. I don't personally think there's a lot of competition, just because Wisconsin Public Radio and WORT and the LPs, they have such different audiences and such different structures, and they're doing so many different things that I don't think there's really... I mean, I can't imagine WART or public radio being threatened by us.
Well, I don't think we would have gotten on the air without Norm Stockwell's
help, right?
And he was working for WART at the time.
He helped us get on the air as well. The
article in that newsletter shows Norm and Molly Stentz and
Laura Gutconnect is also all, wonderful. Yeah.
All there helping out, getting us on the air.
And the roof or something.
Yeah.
There is a difference between public radio and community radio these days. And that's something I thought of mentioning. If you look at the history of public radio in Wisconsin, back when WHA went on the air, they were much more like a community radio station, much more of a local thing with local people,
local programming.
And volunteers helping to run the station, that sort of thing. But public radio has gotten more and more professional, hiring people to do everything. And so WORT has much more in terms of local roots than the Wisconsin public radio stations do.
More accessible to the community.
Yeah.
Right, and more dependent on community volunteers, and low power radio is even more local because it's a smaller audience in this particular part of town.
Okay. So, what, Elizabeth, what made you decide to move off to Antarctica?
Well, I thought about going to Antarctica for a little while. I don't even remember where it was that I. Like how I got the idea, but I was perusing, or no, I know, because I have a friend of mine who has a friend who works for a recycling company who do recycling in Antarctica, and she mentioned it to me. So I went to the National Science Foundation's U.S. Antarctic Program website, and I looked at the different companies they contract with, and I looked at jobs, and communications operator was the one that stood out to me, where I thought, I can do that. I'm totally qualified for that.
So there was some adventure of just
there was some adventure, yes,
to Antarctica, regardless of what the job was.
Yeah, well, I remember thinking, yes, I will go there and be a janitor. That's totally fine. Turns out, I'm actually more qualified to do this than I am to be a janitor. Because to be a janitor in Antarctica, you have to have some kind of you have to have a certification. You have to have past experience as a janitor, which I do not have, but I do have radio operations, a lot of radio operations experience. So I applied last May and I never heard back. And then I was doing volunteer work in Alaska last fall. And the woman who I was working for has been to Antarctica twice. And she is friends with the woman who's going to be my boss. And she said, oh, well, I'll just, you know, give you, you know, have you exchange emails and you can take it from there. And I said, okay. So I think that was helpful to have.
Okay.
Yeah. Name drop.
And are you going to be exploring New Zealand at all, since that's kind of where you fly off from?
Yeah, they fly me through New Zealand, and I'll have a few days there. And I might spend some time there afterwards, but I'm not sure yet.
Okay.
New Zealand is fabulous.
Yeah, I've heard New Zealand is wonderful. And I'm also hoping to hit South America and Asia next year, and then I will have been to all seven continents.
Okay.
Is that part of your desire to go to Antarctica?
Yes.
Checks off a continent.
Checks off a continent, yeah. And I've been to Africa. That's the second hardest one to get to. So.
Okay.
You do the hard ones first.
Yeah, yes. But no, I think radio broadcasting and community media management is definitely something I want to keep doing.
Is that what you did in Alaska?
No, I was just, I was doing like yard work and helping with construction projects. And there's a organization called Workaway, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with woofers. It basically you sign up, it's $30 for a 2-year membership and you contact hosts like all around the world. And then you work, 20 to 30 hours a week in exchange for room and board. So it's a really, really great way to travel, really great way to get to know a local community.
Mm-hmm.
You get to do things and see things that you would never find in a guidebook. And the only thing you have to pay for is transportation.
To get there.
Yeah, back. Yeah. So I highly, highly, highly recommend it.
Are we going to get program? Is WIDE going to get any programming from you in Antarctica? Is there going to be like a... This week in Antarctica?
I would love that. So I'm definitely going to be recording I'm going to be doing interviews constantly. Like anybody who will let me stick a microphone in their face, I will interview them. The bandwidth, the internet bandwidth in McMurdo is really, really limited.
Right.
What I was told was that the average internet connection for one house is what the entire base of 1,000 people gets. So, I may not be able to share any audio until after I get back. Mm-hmm. But I will be keeping a blog. I'm definitely going to write for the Antarctic Sun. Hopefully do a giant audio release after I get back and just put 100 things on Public Radio Exchange or something and then say, yeah, do what you want with them. I don't care.
So do they have mail service down there?
I believe, they have a ship that comes in with mail, but I don't know if you can mail things out of Antarctica.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Andy, you could be an interviewer.
That's just what I was going to say. Andy, you are great at interviewing.
Yeah.
I'm gonna remember that next time there's a panel.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Says, who should we have?
Be on the panel?
Host the panel.
Host?
Yeah. Yeah.
Be the moderator. Right.
Yeah.
I'm a good heckler from this.
You can do it. You've got really good interview skills.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth, for coming out for this.
Sure. No problem.